This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For those of us who still read books, we have the option of reading e-books if we're willing to pay the money for a reading device. We're going to talk about how e-books are changing the publishing industry. My guest Ken Auletta wrote an article about e-books called Publish or Perish in the August 26th edition of The New Yorker. He writes the magazine's series Annals of Communications and is the author of the book Googled about how Google has changed the world. Auletta says that although e-books account for only an estimated 3-5% of the book market, their sales increased 177% last year. At the end of last year, Amazon, which produces the reading device the Kindle, accounted for about 80% of electronic book sales. The landscape is changing with Apple's recent release of the iPad. Unlike the Kindle, which is a dedicated reading device, the iPad is a multimedia device that can access web and email and download video. But the iPad costs more and is heavier than the Kindle. Last week, Barnes & Noble announced that it would add software to its electronic reader, the Nook, that will let users access the web and play games. So the field is getting more competitive, and the publishing industry is hoping that ebook competition will be good for their profits. Ken Auletta, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, in your article, you say that in some publishing circles, the iPad has been called the Jesus tablet because it has the potential to be the savior of the publishing industry. But I think it's fair to say within the publishing industry, ebooks are seen as part threat, part savior?
Correct. The savior is that it opens up a new market, potentially, particularly to younger people, their hope. Secondly, what publishers hope to do, and they've belatedly jumped into this, and I think they were much too late, but nevertheless, they're trying to create multimedia functionality out of a book. So they're offering a new kind of book in an e-book. It's not just an electronic book. It's a book that allows you to go to an archive, to access things in a multimedia dimension. So their hope is that they can actually charge more for that book and open up a new revenue stream. It is also seen as a savior in that by the iPad coming into the market, it gives the publishers leverage over Amazon. And they were afraid that Amazon, with an 80% market share of ebooks, would basically continue to lower prices and basically have them over a barrel. And now they feel they've regained some leverage and regained leverage over their ability to price books. A problem for publishers and not a savior in that as ebooks expand exponentially and expected one day to reach 25-40% of all books published, what does this do to bookstores? Already independent bookstores are down to 10% of all the bookstores and bookselling places. And the problem with that is that independent bookstores with a staff of people who you tend to know, you tend to have gone to that store, they are people who really are noted for reading many books and for spotting that first-time novel, that nonfiction book by a new author. And that word of mouth and their recommendations have helped spur sales for years. And the worry is what replaces that. Because a bookstore, it's very hard to see how a bookstore, which is selling a book, let's say, for $26, can compete with an ebook selling for $13.
So let's look at the pricing of ebooks and the war that threatened to break out about the pricing. Amazon had been pricing its books at $9.99, which is much cheaper than the 20-something dollar price that you're likely to find in a bookstore for a hardcover book. So let's just start with how had Kindle managed to price ebooks so low?
What Kindle was doing was, let's say a book normally selling for $26 in a store, the publisher sells it to most bookstores or to Amazon for half that price. Let's say they sold it for $13. What Amazon would do was subsidize the difference, take a loss of $3 on each of those books and sell it for $9.99 and hope that they would make up for it by doing two things. One, by selling Kindles. They don't tell you how much profit they make or how many Kindles sell, but the estimate is about 3 million Kindles are out there, and they're making a nice buck on each Kindle. In addition to that, by gaining market share, and already they were up to 80% market share of electronic books, the fear the publishers had is that Amazon would continue to drop that ebook price from $9.99 lower and lower and lower, as is the tendency in the online world. It is done more cheaply, and customers expect lower and lower prices. And publishers felt that that basically threatened their basic business.
Now, with the arrival of the iPad, the new Apple multimedia and reading device, the pricing system is changing. How is it changing?
Well, what the publishers got Steve Jobs to agree to is to allow them to set what's called an agency model, meaning they could basically set the price.
The publishers could set the price.
Yes, and Steve Jobs will go along with that for at least 1 year. And obviously there's a question whether he will continue beyond a year at that pricing. But that pricing is going to be, instead of $9.99 as Amazon was doing, it's going to range between $12 and $15, let's say. And what happened is that Amazon did not want to go along, but five of the six major publishers who publish 60% of all the hardcover books squeezed Amazon, and with the backing of Apple and with the coming backing of Google, Google said that they would go along with the so-called agency model as well. Amazon was forced to surrender and agree to that as well.
But Apple has agreed to the agency model for 1 year. So that means after a year they could say, didn't work for us, we're going to change it, right?
Correct. And if you look at what happened in the music business with Apple and iTunes, the music companies were very upset that Steve Jobs set the price of a single track or an individual song at 99 cents. Now, you can make the argument that iTunes, in fact, has been good for the music business and that the music companies were really stupid to say you have to buy the entire CD, you can't buy an individual song. But nevertheless, there has been real friction with not just the music companies but the television companies with iTunes. Steve Jobs was setting the price, and that upset them as well. So is that a model for what's going to happen in the book business a year from now? It might be.
Now, you said that ebooks are basically calling into question the whole system of how books are priced. What has the system been based on until now, until the arrival of ebooks?
Well, what happened was that the bookstores are taking a chance on books, and it used to be you didn't buy books at airport kiosks, or you didn't buy them at Walmarts and price clubs, and you didn't buy them electronically. You bought them in bookstores, first independent bookstores, then chains. During the Depression, in order to get bookstores to take risks on books that they would stock, the publishers agreed to have a returns policy. That is to say, if you buy and display my books in your bookstore, any books you don't sell, you can return to me at no cost to you, the bookstore. And what the problem is that according to American publishers, roughly 40% of all the books are returned. And that's very expensive for publishers. And with ebooks, there are no returns. And there's no inventory that you have to stock up, and no warehousing, and no distribution costs. So it's a much more efficient system and a much cheaper system to produce a book. On the other hand, what it does is it threatens the very existence of bookstores. And that is something that worries the publishers. I mean, you could argue that the bookstores could, for roughly $100,000, buy a print-on-demand machine that can print out in a couple minutes any book. But $100,000 is not something that most certainly independent bookstores can afford to do.
So publishers, I think, are also worried that the electronic reading device manufacturers like Amazon and Apple will start approaching writers directly and cut out the publishers altogether.
They're less worried about Apple doing that, since Apple really isn't selling, they're in the business of selling hardware and the iPad, the iPod, et cetera. But Amazon has actually made some deals with authors. Stephen Covey is one, but others as well, and has actually approached authors and editors to try and look to hire, not only hire editors to work for Amazon, but also to procure books for them, and offering authors a much larger commission than the commission they get from hardcover publishers.
So what do you think the odds are that publishers will actually eventually be cut out of the equation?
I think one of the things that happens, Terry, in the online world, there's always a question is who is the middleman? Who is the superfluous middleman that you really don't need? Do you really need publishers? I mean, if Amazon is going to provide marketing and provide editing,
Are they providing editing?
Do that? Well, what they were moving towards is to hire editors to do that, and to actually go out and acquire books. And there's a whole issue now about who owns the ebook rights for books that were published before ebooks rights were stipulated in current publishing contracts in the last 10 years. So those old books, the William Faulkner's and Norman Mailer's that were published 10, 15 years ago, who owns the electronic rights to them? And can Norman Mailer's estate go to bypass Random House, which was his publisher, and say, no, you don't have the rights to that backlist ebook. We're going to sell it to Amazon or someone else. I mean, there are a lot of others. So there's a growth of ebook publishing. People who say, you don't need a publisher anymore. Publishers really are cutting, they've cut back their marketing and they've cut back their editing costs, and come to us, we'll do it, and we'll give you a larger commission on that, and you'll be happier. And so that puts publishers in the position of saying, we have to prove that we are providing a service that can't be matched by others. And the same issue applies to agents. Are they going to become middlemen? So I think everyone in this world, when you think about the internet and what it does, think about travel agents, think about real estate agents. What's the value added that you offer the consumer? That's a basic question.
Now, you mentioned the whole question of if books were written before ebooks existed and the contract said nothing about ebooks, who owns the right to the ebooks? And there's a big story in that world that just broke, which is that the family of the late writer William Styron has gotten the rights from his publisher to publish the ebooks themselves, to not do it through the publisher, but to take the rights themselves. What's the significance of that case?
Well, Random House, which announced that decision on releasing it on Monday, they went to pains to say that this is just a one-time agreement with the Styron estate. It's not for all of Styron's books, I believe, just for some. So presumably, I presume what happened there is they made some kind of accommodation where we'll let you do with these books, but these others will retain. I assume that. I'm not certain of that. But in any case, they went to pains to say, and this is actually a budding issue between authors and agents on one side and publishers on the other. If you look at the old book contracts, and there was actually a ruling on this earlier in this century, where the court said that if a contract with an author is silent about rights, be it paperback rights or movie rights or ebook rights, there were no ebooks at the time, automatically, they declare that the rights revert to the author, not to the publisher. Publishers are asserting that in contracts signed before ebooks were a factor. In other words, now any book contract talks about ebooks, but earlier contracts like Styron's did not. And publishers are claiming that that right is theirs. This will be adjudicated and fought over intensely. Because obviously, if you're an author, if you can get those ebook rights, and if you're an agent representing that author, if you can get those ebook rights for yourself, your royalty is going to be much larger than if you have to give the bulk of it to your publisher. And your argument is that if the contract is silent about that, as the courts ruled initially against Random House, they're mine. And publishers are saying, no, we put in all the sweat, we put in all the work, we edited, and they're ours.
Now, you recently published your book about Google and how Google has changed the world. Google is figuring into the story that we're talking about now, the story of how ebooks are changing publishing. What's Google's part in all of this?
Well, Google initially did what engineers do, which is they said, wouldn't it be cool? We could actually come up with a system to digitize all the 20 or so million books ever published, and wouldn't that be cool? And of course, it would be cool and great for me when we do our searches to have books included in those searches. What the engineers at Google didn't think to do was to consult with the publishers and authors who own the copyrights for those books. So they got a lawsuit. And ultimately, they settled that lawsuit in 2008 and agreed, and this is a very significant victory for copyright holders, they agreed to pay $125 million to authors and publishers in order to have the right to digitize those books. But now what Google is doing, assuming that the courts approve their settlement with the publishers and the Authors Guild, what Google hopes to do is basically to create an online bookstore as well and compete against Apple and against Amazon. The publishers welcome that because the more competition, the more leverage they have.
So now that you have several different e-publishers putting out books, what are the odds that you'll be able to download all books on all devices? Or will devices largely be Will the books that you are able to download largely be controlled by their compatibility with the device you own?
Oh, you've really touched on an important difference and an issue here going forward. With Apple and with Amazon, you can only download a book on their devices. What Google is promising when they start their program, assuming they do this summer, that's their target, they are saying that you can download our book on any device of your choice. So it's not a closed system the way the Amazon Kindle is a closed system or the iPads, iTunes, or iBook is a closed system. And that's going to be an interesting test, what happens there.
But aren't the companies going to have apps that will enable you to to download the other company's books on your device?
Well, you will have apps, which obviously Apple will get a piece of. Apple is in the app business, and they have. In fact, Amazon has an app on the iPad, so you can actually order Amazon books on the iPad. Yes, then you can download it to, say, to your desktop computer or your laptop computer. But Apple, of course, is making a chunk of change on that.
When Apple started iTunes, there was already a culture of free music. There was a lot of, like, sharing of free music through the internet, a lot of sites where you could download free music. The music industry was very upset about that. And Apple, as far as the music industry was concerned, Apple was selling stuff cheaply, but at least they were selling it, which was good news for the industry compared to the giveaways. Now, in the book world, there hasn't been that culture of free books. There's been a culture of giving away newspaper and magazine content for free, but not books. So is that affecting how the new world of e-books is being shaped?
I think you're quite right that piracy has not been the worry for book publishers that it has been for others. But the larger point here, if you go back to when iTunes began in 2003, what it really did was challenge the very culture of the internet. The culture of the internet is a culture that grew up around the notion that information and entertainment should be free, that the internet is free. What Apple did was introduce the notion that you should pay for content. And in that sense, it was salutary for the music industry, but also salutary for anyone in the content business. And you see this world of the internet changing very dramatically. I mean, Amazon is an online world that says you want to buy a book, you have to pay for it. That is a very important step in the notion that all people who are traditional publishers or in the content business are terrified of. They say, how do we charge for our content on the internet? How do we avoid people either pirating it or taking it, thinking that they deserve to have it for free? So you can make the argument that what's happened is that the digital world, the Amazons and the Apples, have become pioneers in the notion of charging for content. And now you see a change taking place because of the recession of late 07 and 08, where suddenly companies like Google wake up and realize that, oh my God, we are relying totally on advertising to support and sustain our business. And advertising has fallen off. We need another revenue model, another source of revenue. That is good news for traditional publishers and for people in the traditional content business, because it means that the digital world is moving closer to them.
So how do you read now? Do you read a lot of e-books? Do you read a lot of, like, hardcover books? Do you read books?
I have a Kindle. I'm waiting to buy the iPad until the 3G or the faster model comes out in a month or so. When I go on vacation, I take my Kindle and read on that because it's much lighter. When I say lighter, I don't mean the 3/4 pound of the Kindle. I mean, instead of taking 5 books, I take my Kindle, and they're there, and you can download in 60 seconds. I love that. I actually prefer to read a book in hardcover because I can mark it in a way I can't in the same efficiency of a Kindle, and it's on my bookshelf, and I can refer to it as I'm writing. Some years later, I say, wait, wasn't there a Bob Caro story about Lyndon Johnson and the Senate that, and I can find it much more easily if it's on my bookshelf. The other thing I don't like about the Kindle, which is an advantage I think that the iPad offers, the Kindle doesn't paginate. You don't know what page you're on. It says you are 52% of the way through this book. But the Apple iPad will actually paginate. So you see on page 10 or 20 or whatever. And that's an advantage. I mean, I find that more attractive.
Well, Ken Auletta, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Ken Auletta's article, Publish or Perish, was published in the April 26th edition of The New Yorker. His latest book is called Googled. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Tribeca Film Festival is underway in New York. The new film Please Give will have its New York premiere at the festival tonight. My guest Oliver Platt is one of the stars of Please Give. In the series The West Wing, Platt played the White House counsel. He also co-starred in Frost Nixon, Kinsey, and Bulworth, and was featured in the TV series Bored to Death, Nip Tuck, and Huff. In Please Give, Platt plays a husband who's the father of a teenage girl. Catherine Keener plays his wife, who feels guilty about her affluent lifestyle and tries to compensate by doing things like giving homeless people, or people she mistakenly thinks are homeless, $20 bills. The couple owns a store in New York that sells vintage furniture. They buy most of the furniture from people whose elderly parents have died and want to sell their belongings. The couple buys cheap, then sells the furniture at high prices, which is contributing to the wife's guilt. Here's a scene with Platt and Keener in their store.
I mean, who's to say this stuff isn't valuable?
I can. This stuff is not valuable.
Somebody liked it. I mean, in 15 years, this chair will be worth a ton of money because some genius German designer, you know, designed it.
We're not going to sell any of this.
I already sold two shelves for $1,400.
You did? That's great.
No, it's not. I don't feel very good about it.
I don't understand.
I practically stole from them.
Well, then why'd you charge them a ton of money?
I wanted to. And I've been feeling really suspicious lately, Alex. And people have been coming in asking questions.
Like what?
Like, where does your stuff come from and how do you get it?
You know, people are like that. They're just curious. They're curious about where the stuff comes from.
No, this is different. People who we've bought stuff from are sending in friends or lawyers to find out how much we're selling these things for.
Hun, your guilt is warping you.
Why isn't it warping you?
It is. Your guilt is warping me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my guest, Oliver Platt, with Catherine Keener in a scene from the new film, Please Give. Oliver Platt, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Terry. The pleasure's mine.
And now Nicole Holofcener, who wrote and directed Please Give, was quoted as saying that she wrote the role with you in mind. Did she tell you exactly what about you she had in mind when she wrote the part?
I don't know. I think it's because I have the it must be my struggling schlub quality. There's an aspect to Alex where I think he's kind of, you know, he has a kind of marvelous cluelessness, which I think on a certain level allows him to get away with the things that he does in the movie. Not that he's actually getting away with them, because I think that he's in the sense of getting over, because I think that he's actually just as surprised by what happens to him in the movie as anybody else is. And if you were to ask him why this has happened, you know, this relationship, this extracurricular relationship that might or might not occur in the movie occurs, he wouldn't necessarily be able to tell you.
Right. So getting back to the fact that Nicole Holofcener said she wrote your part with you in mind, she wanted you to play it. In spite of that, did she make you audition after she wrote it?
She didn't. We had a delightful cup of coffee at a cafe in my neighborhood, and
in New York?
You know, yeah, in New York, in the West Village, and she asked me to do it. I was delighted. Yeah, if only all meetings with directors were like that.
Right. What did she want to know?
It was interesting. I think, and she would tell you this, that it was the one role in the movie that she wasn't absolutely sure about a couple of aspects of. And I think that as a man, she was like, you know, how do you respond to this? I think it's in particular, it's the through line of how does this extracurricular friendship take place and what has to be going on or maybe not going on in a marriage that is ostensibly a good marriage to have something like that happen. And so we talked about that a lot. And not that we came up with all kinds of answers, because one of the things that we decided that there wasn't necessarily an answer, that it was maybe a mysterious thing. You know, and it's, which is one of the things that I love so much about the movie, is I think that this movie has a healthy dose of what really ultimately compels me about any narrative that, you know, that I want to get involved in, is there is mystery. And when I say mystery, I don't mean a whodunit kind of mystery, but a human mystery, human condition mystery. You know, what that thing of people kind of stumbling around looking to get made whole, you know, even if they don't know that they are.
A lot of people know you from your work on The West Wing as the White House counsel. And so I want to play a scene from an episode of The West Wing. And this is a scene, you've just found out that the president has MS and has withheld the information for some time. And you're worried about the legal implications of this for the president and perhaps for other people on his staff who might have known and withheld information. So you're questioning the people on the staff. And in this scene, you're questioning the president's press secretary, played by Allison Janney, who found out 6 hours ago that he has MS.
Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Should I have my lawyer here?
I'm your lawyer.
You're the president's lawyer.
I'm the White House counsel, CJ. Have you ever lied about the president's health?
When did he tell you?
I'm sorry?
When did the president tell you?
6 days ago.
And Josh?
2 days after that.
Toby?
2 days before he told me. CJ, have you ever lied about the president's health?
And Leo, he told more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've had this for 6 hours now, so maybe giving me some room wouldn't be totally out of line. You know what I'm saying, Oliver?
CJ, I'm going to have to ask you some questions. Less you can be pissed at the world for no particular reason, the better, I think.
I don't know you.
I'm sorry?
I was told to report to you. I don't know you. You've been here, what?
3 months.
3 months, so yeah. Why should I trust you?
Well, I don't care if you trust me or not.
Imagine my shock.
I've got better things to do with my imagination.
I think this is going really well so far, Oliver. It's almost hard to believe that 4 different women have sued you for divorce.
Well, you can do that if you want, CJ. I've been through it a couple times with Josh and Toby, but sooner or later you're going to have to answer questions.
Either to you or...
A grand jury.
Compelled by...
A Justice Department subpoena.
Well, I have to tell you, it'll be the first time I've been asked out in quite a while, so...
It's entirely possible that the president has committed multiple counts of a federal crime to which you were an accomplice.
That much has sunk in the last 6 hours.
Has it?
Yes.
So why don't you knock off the cutie pie crap and answer the damn question?
What was the question?
Have you ever lied about the president's health? What is your answer?
Many, many times.
Great scene from The West Wing with my guest, Oliver Platt, along with Allison Janney. You must have been so happy to get that part on The West Wing.
You know, it's... Funny story about that. I had actually just had my own television show that I did for NBC unceremoniously ripped off the air after 3 episodes, and I was or 4 episodes, and I was making a movie.
Which show was this?
It was called Deadline, and I was making a movie in Vancouver, and my manager called me and said, "Aaron Sorkin wants you to be on The West Wing," but I didn't want to do it, and I thought, well, I've got to read it so that I can call Aaron up. And then I read it, you know, and I was – and that kind of actor thing kicked in, like, you know, well, I'm not going to let anybody else do this, you know. I mean, it was the writing was just so spectacular. And, you know, that's the strange texture of life and show business, isn't it? I mean, it turned out to be a complete highlight for me. You know, I did 8 episodes of the show, and I just had so much fun and it kind of restored my belief in television.
So what did you do to prepare to play the part of the White House counsel?
You know, I actually had very, very little time. And, you know, fortunately, my father was a career diplomat. I grew up in Washington. So I'd been drinking the water all my life, so to speak. And, you know, the writing of that character was so extraordinary. And it was also... I think I pat myself on the back for being smart enough to recognize that it was actually a very different character in the culture of that show. You know, the kind of the dirty little secret about The West Wing, what made it so much fun to watch on a kind of voyeuristic, well, I mean, a level of fantasy, really, is here you had this great man in the White House who's surrounded by all these marvelous people who were bright and educated and had their hearts in the right place, who were completely worshipped him and loyal to him. And along came this guy who was actually just as loyal, but he was much more interested in tough love than necessarily – not that they kowtowed, but they treated him with kid gloves, you know. And here was a guy who recognized how much trouble this man was potentially in and was extremely direct with him. I think whoever played that part, you know, it would have landed because the character really provided a counterpoint in a way. It cut across the current of the rest of the personalities in that show. And so all I really needed to do was to get on the horse and ride, you know. And it's not an easy show to work on because you have to say all of the words exactly the way they're written, and which is not, you know, always my forte. And there's this nice little lady who sits behind the camera, not the script supervisor. And she would come out and tell you afterwards if you literally got an A or a the or a but wrong, and you'd have to do it all again. And, you know, that Oliver Babish, he was a talky fellow. And there were some big, long speeches that I had to and I didn't know, you know, when I finally called Aaron said to me, you know, oh, Oliver, just, you know, we're so thrilled you're doing it. Just make it your own. And so when somebody says to me, make it your own, I thought he meant, oh, I can kind of like, you know, cross this out or make this more comfortable coming out of my mouth. That's not what Aaron meant. And, you know, Aaron has every right to not mean that. He just meant come and, you know, and have a good time and be you. So I had a little hazing that went on as I figured out that you had to say it exactly as it was written and sweat it out.
So you said that reading the script word for word isn't your forte. Is that because of bad memory or just wanting to make it more comfortable for you to say?
Television is much more of a writer's medium. And I hadn't done a lot of television at that time. And I'd done a lot of movies, and you know, I came up doing movies in the 80s and the 90s when, you know, movies were very concept heavy and the script wasn't always the most important thing. You know, big, huge, multi-million dollar deals were made on napkins because a star had agreed to do some sort of idea and that this writer would do it. And, you know, the writers were often pulling their hair out, being rewritten by, you know, I don't know, schlubs like me.
Could you give an example of the kind of line that Aaron Sorkin wrote that you'd maybe either get wrong or slightly rewrite to make it more comfortable for you, and then you had to do it over again exactly as written?
The example I can give you is every single one, you know, because he's he's very fastidious, and he has every right to be. And there's an absolute music and a rhythm to the way he writes. And it was a wonderful exercise for me as an actor, you know. Because God knows that's what we're supposed to do. You know, I'd gotten lazy or I'd gotten, you know, the conditions that I just described to you. It gives you a little bit of a sense of entitlement, and it makes you lazy.
Since we were just talking about working on the TV series The West Wing, let's stay in the White House for a moment and hear a scene from Frost Nixon. And this is about the making of the now famous interviews that British journalist and talk show host David Frost recorded with President Nixon after Watergate. And you play Bob Zelnick, a journalist who is helping with the preparation of the interviews. And in this scene, as part of the prep, David Frost is doing a kind of rehearsal with you standing in for Nixon. So you're playing the part of Nixon in this little rehearsal that they're doing. And the scene begins with you doing a voiceover.
Because I had written about and watched Nixon for years, I got to play him in our rehearsals. You know, the fellas would throw me a question, and I would try and anticipate what his response might be.
Okay, the White House taping system.
Ours was not the first administration to use taping systems. Lyndon Johnson's White House used them, so did Kennedy.
Houston plant, wiretapping, and alleged abuses of power.
Let me tell you, other administrations were up to far worse.
And just for fun, your close friend, Jack Kennedy.
That man, he screwed anything that moved, fixed elections, and took us into Vietnam. And the American people, they loved him for it. Whereas I, Richard Milhouse Nixon, worked around the clock in their service, and they hated me. Look. Look. Now I'm sweating.
Damn it. Damn it. And Kennedy's so goddamn handsome. I'm blue-eyed. And women all over him. He anything that moved and everything. Had a go at Checkers once. The poor little bitch was never the same.
That's my guest, Oliver Platt, in a scene from Frost Nixon. Now, you were born in 1960. Did Watergate have any impact on you?
You know, it did, because we were living at the start of Watergate. I was living in Washington, actually, and then we were living in Japan when Nixon resigned. And I remember very clearly we were driving out to the country, and the news came over the radio. My parents pulled the car over, and they told us all to listen. I remember my parents being utterly consumed by the Watergate hearings, everybody being consumed by the Watergate hearings. And I just remember it being, you know, I was what? Nixon resigned in 72, 73. So is that right, Terry? So I was 12 or 13. And then, and it was what,
74,
several years.
74 maybe?
74. Like I say, I was conscious of my parents being obsessed by it. I didn't get interested in politics till I was a little bit older.
Now, your father was a career diplomat. He was an ambassador to Pakistan, Zambia, the Philippines. What were you doing in Japan?
That was an earlier point in his career. He wasn't an ambassador yet, but he was a senior member of the political section of the embassy. And I was, you know, I was going to school. I was just being an American teenager in Japan.
So what impact do you think Watergate had on your father, since he was at that point representing the Nixon administration?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, because, you know, my father actually went on all of those trips with first Secretary Rogers to China, and then with Kissinger to China, and then ultimately with Nixon to China.
Wow.
He's actually just published a memoir about it called China Boys, about the opening of China. And he really had a remarkable perspective on it. And he has a home movie, you know, of Nixon getting off the plane and shaking Chou Enlai's hand. And he's standing literally, you know, 15 yards away from him when that happened. And so he really, I think my father had complicated feelings about it.
So when you had to play the part in Frost Nixon of Bob Zelnick, and you sat in for Nixon in this kind of role-play rehearsal of the David Frost interview, what were you going for when you were doing, like, an impression of Nixon?
Well, you know, it was very easy, because I unyoked myself from this aspect. I talked to Ron about it, and we said, listen, the whole idea is that, you know, Bob Zelnick's not an actor. You don't have to be a good Nixon. You know, you could, as a matter of fact, the worst Nixon you are, the better, and, you know, maybe the funnier. And so I just kind of let loose with whatever I remembered about, you know, because everybody back in those days, you know, had a Nixon impression. You
absolutely.
You couldn't turn on, like, you'd watch Rowan and Martin's laugh in, and everybody was imitating Nixon, holding up their, you know, their arms in the peace signs and kind of hunching their shoulders and shaking their jowls, you know. So we just had fun with it. I didn't at all study any sort of Nixon. I just pulled it out of my memory, my perverse memory.
So where does acting come in? How did you get interested in acting?
You know, we moved regularly. We moved every two or three years, sometimes shorter spans than that. And, you know, it wasn't always easy being the new kid. You know, after one particularly difficult transition, I think, when I came back from Hong Kong, and I came back and I went to quite a little bit of a Tony school in Washington, D.C. And I, you know, for whatever reason, I was the only new kid, and I had a very, very difficult time. But for whatever reason, I auditioned for the Christmas pageant, and I played, I was cast as the innkeeper who turned Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus away from the inn. And I said my line, and God knows why, but the place went nuts. And it must be because I said it so inappropriately, because, you know, I don't think that, you know, the innkeeper turning Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus away from the inn is necessarily a hilarious moment.
That's right.
but however I said it, I got a big reaction. And, you know, and it's a kind of, you know, when you are a I know this sounds so pathetic as I tell the story, but you pay attention. All of a sudden I was going, ooh, you know, I'll have a little more of this. You know, when you're like a friendless loser and all of a sudden, you know, you get a rise out of a group of people, no matter how inadvertent or wrongheaded, you remember it. And what happened? So I kept on auditioning for, I kept on, you know, doing school plays. And it became this instant way, you know, because I kept on moving around, of course. And then it became kind of instant way to plug in to a group, you know, to a subculture, to a group of friends. It really was a survival mechanism, you know.
Had you been in musicals before?
I had been in musicals in high school, but, you know, the high school musical and the Broadway musical are two completely different beasts. I've done plays before, you know, in the professional environment, and you're really worrying about the play and the text. But with a musical, there's choreography, there's learning the songs, there's, you know, quote-unquote dancing, which I only say quote-unquote because, they were very, very kind about the demands they put on me for dancing. There's just a lot of difference. There's a lot of stuff. And it makes it thrilling, you know, once you figure out how to do it. You know, I'll never forget, like, the first time we're sitting in these beautiful rehearsal studios on 42nd Street that have these huge windows, and you're kind of looking out over Times Square and Broadway. And the first time, you know, that I was sitting in the middle of this chorus of singers in the cast, and the first time we all sang, you know, Luck Be a Lady. I mean, you're just sitting there going, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this, you know.
So, sadly, this Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls that you were in did not get great reviews, and it closed in a few months. Was that kind of heartbreaking for you?
You know, it wasn't easy, but we got to do it for a while. And, you know, when the show wasn't well received, we were all disappointed. And your first response is, oh, God, I wish this would just go away. But then when it didn't, you settled into it. And, you know, it's Guys and Dolls, and people would come, and despite what the critics said, they would have a ball. And, you know, I don't know how to describe it. You know, there's something about working in that environment that is absolutely magic. You know, I'd run off stage right. I have to make an exit stage left in 47 seconds. You run down the stairs, you know, three sweaty dancing girls, you know, in their hot box outfits pass you, you know, giggling on the way up the stairs. You take a right. You pass the wig room. You look in the wig room. There's a guy dressed in a pinstripe suit, like trying to put the moves on one of the hairdressers. You know, you're trying to follow this little yellow line. You hear the washing machines humming, you know, because they're already doing the clothes. Then you pass like the trap room. There's a guy sitting in front of a glowing monitor pressing buttons because something isn't functioning. You finally get to the stairs. You're ready to go up. And then like Benny South Street and nicely come barreling down the stairs, you know, like laughing about something that just went wrong on stage. And then you barrel up the stairs, and then you see the security guard, and he's watching the Yankee game. You know, he's lit by the glow of the Yankee game. He's got this earpiece in, but he's drooling, and he's asleep, and he's perfectly lit by this little spotlight above. And then you rush back on stage, and then the whole time you're listening to this gorgeous Frank Lesser music. And once again, you go, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this.
You know, I especially noticed in your new movie, Please Give, how tall you are. You kind of tower over the actress who plays your daughter, and you tower over Catherine Keener. You're a big man.
Well, thank you.
How do you feel like you use your size in different performances?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Sometimes it needs to be used, and sometimes it wants to be not used, you know. And the great thing about film is that they can make you as short or tall as they want, you know, by putting other actors on boxes or putting you in a ditch. You know, I have to say the honest answer is I don't think about it too much, you know. I think about it if I need it. And then I realize that it's just there. You know, if I have to be imposing, I just, you know, it's talk softly and carry a big stick. I mean, I kind of... You are the big stick. You know what I mean? If you have that size.
So what's a role where you've used it to be imposing? West Wing?
You know, maybe Oliver Babish, since we've been talking about that a little bit. Uh-huh. You know, he was a very imposing character.
Now, how do you think your size affects the roles that you're cast in?
A lot of directors are surprised by my size. They think that I'm shorter. I think it affects it maybe secondarily, but it's not like people say, let's get that guy, he's so tall. People are almost always surprised by it.
What about being like a little husky?
I think that, you know, I don't know. I wonder about that endlessly. I think that sometimes it keeps me away from certain roles. I think it gets me other roles. In the end, it's probably a wash, but it's just what I am.
Well, Oliver Platt, I wish you good luck with your new movie and your new TV series, and I really want to thank you for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Oliver Platt stars with Catherine Keener in the new film Please Give. It has its New York premiere tonight at the Tribeca Film Festival and opens Friday in New York and L.A. You can see clips from Please Give on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Tribeca Film Festival is underway in New York. The new film Please Give will have its New York premiere at the festival tonight. My guest Oliver Platt is one of the stars of Please Give. In the series The West Wing, Platt played the White House counsel. He also co-starred in Frost Nixon, Kinsey, and Bulworth, and was featured in the TV series Bored to Death, Nip Tuck, and Huff. In Please Give, Platt plays a husband who's the father of a teenage girl. Catherine Keener plays his wife, who feels guilty about her affluent lifestyle and tries to compensate by doing things like giving homeless people, or people she mistakenly thinks are homeless, $20 bills. The couple owns a store in New York that sells vintage furniture. They buy most of the furniture from people whose elderly parents have died and want to sell their belongings. The couple buys cheap, then sells the furniture at high prices, which is contributing to the wife's guilt. Here's a scene with Platt and Keener in their store.
I mean, who's to say this stuff isn't valuable?
I can. This stuff is not valuable.
Somebody liked it. I mean, in 15 years, this chair will be worth a ton of money because some genius German designer, you know, designed it.
We're not going to sell any of this.
I already sold two shelves for $1,400.
You did? That's great.
No, it's not. I don't feel very good about it.
I don't understand.
I practically stole from them.
Well, then why'd you charge them a ton of money?
I wanted to. And I've been feeling really suspicious lately, Alex. And people have been coming in asking questions.
Like what?
Like, where does your stuff come from and how do you get it?
You know, people are like that. They're just curious. They're curious about where the stuff comes from.
No, this is different. People who we've bought stuff from are sending in friends or lawyers to find out how much we're selling these things for.
Hun, your guilt is warping you.
Why isn't it warping you?
It is. Your guilt is warping me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my guest, Oliver Platt, with Catherine Keener in a scene from the new film, Please Give. Oliver Platt, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Terry. The pleasure's mine.
And now, Nicole Holofcener, who wrote and directed Please Give, was quoted as saying that she wrote the role with you in mind. Did she tell you exactly what about you she had in mind when she wrote the part?
I don't know. I think it's because I have the it must be my struggling schlub quality. There's an aspect to Alex where I think he's kind of, you know, he has a kind of marvelous cluelessness, which I think on a certain level allows him to get away with the things that he does in the movie. Not that he's actually getting away with them, because I think that he's in the sense of getting over, because I think that he's actually just as surprised by what happens to him in the movie as anybody else is. And if you were to ask him why this has happened, you know, this relationship, this extracurricular relationship that might or might not occur in the movie occurs, he wouldn't necessarily be able to tell you.
Right. So getting back to the fact that Nicole Holofcener said she wrote your part with you in mind, she wanted you to play it. In spite of that, did she make you audition after she wrote it?
She didn't. We had a delightful cup of coffee at a cafe in my neighborhood, and
in New York?
You know, yeah, in New York, in the West Village, and she asked me to do it. I was delighted. Yeah, if only all meetings with directors were like that.
Right. What did she want to know?
It was interesting. I think, and she would tell you this, that it was the one role in the movie that she wasn't absolutely sure about a couple of aspects of. And I think that as a man, she was like, you know, how do you respond to this? I think it's in particular, it's the through line of how does this extracurricular friendship take place and what has to be going on or maybe not going on in a marriage that is ostensibly a good marriage to have something like that happen. And so we talked about that a lot. And not that we came up with all kinds of answers, because one of the things that we decided that there wasn't necessarily an answer, that it was maybe a mysterious thing. You know, and it's, which is one of the things that I love so much about the movie, is I think that this movie has a healthy dose of what really ultimately compels me about any narrative that, you know, that I want to get involved in, is there is mystery. And when I say mystery, I don't mean a whodunit kind of mystery, but a human mystery, human condition mystery. You know, what that thing of people kind of stumbling around looking to get made whole, you know, even if they don't know that they are.
A lot of people know you from your work on The West Wing as the White House counsel. And so I want to play a scene from an episode of The West Wing. And this is a scene, you've just found out that the president has MS and has withheld the information for some time. And you're worried about the legal implications of this for the president and perhaps for other people on his staff who might have known and withheld information. So you're questioning the people on the staff. And in this scene, you're questioning the president's press secretary, played by Allison Janney, who found out 6 hours ago that he has MS.
Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Should I have my lawyer here?
I'm your lawyer.
You're the president's lawyer.
I'm the White House counsel, CJ. Have you ever lied about the president's health?
When did he tell you?
I'm sorry?
When did the president tell you?
6 days ago.
And Josh?
2 days after that.
Toby?
2 days before he told me. CJ, have you ever lied about the president's health?
And Leo, he told more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've had this for 6 hours now, so maybe giving me some room wouldn't be totally out of line. You know what I'm saying, Oliver?
CJ, I'm going to have to ask you some questions. Less you can be pissed at the world for no particular reason, the better, I think.
I don't know you.
I'm sorry?
I was told to report to you. I don't know you. You've been here, what?
3 months.
3 months, so
yeah.
Why should I trust you?
Well, I don't care if you trust me or not.
Imagine my shock.
I got better things to do with my imagination.
I think this is going really well so far, Oliver. It's almost hard to believe that 4 different women have sued you for divorce.
Well, you can do that if you want, CJ. I've been through it a couple times with Josh and Toby, but sooner or later you're going to have to answer questions.
Either to you or...
A grand jury.
Compelled by...
A Justice Department subpoena.
Well, I have to tell you, it'll be the first time I've been asked out in quite a while, so...
It's entirely possible that the president has committed multiple counts of a federal crime to which you were an accomplice.
That much has sunk in the last 6 hours.
Has it?
Yes.
So why don't you knock off the cutie pie crap and answer the damn question?
What was the question?
Have you ever lied about the president's health? What is your answer?
Many, many times.
Great scene from The West Wing with my guest Oliver Platt, along with Allison Janney. You must have been so happy to get that part on The West Wing.
You know, it's... Funny story about that. I had actually just had my own television show that I did for NBC unceremoniously ripped off the air after 3 episodes, and I was or 4 episodes, and I was making a movie.
Which show was this?
It was called Deadline, and mm-hmm. I was making a movie in Vancouver, and my manager called me and said, "Aaron Sorkin wants you to be on The West Wing," but I didn't want to do it, and I thought, well, I've got to read it so that I can call Aaron up. And then I read it, you know, and I was – and that kind of actor thing kicked in, like, you know, well, I'm not going to let anybody else do this, you know. I mean, it was the writing was just so spectacular. And, you know, that's the strange texture of life and show business, isn't it? I mean, it turned out to be a complete highlight for me. You know, I did 8 episodes of the show, and I just had so much fun and it kind of restored my belief in television.
So what did you do to prepare to play the part of the White House counsel?
You know, I actually had very, very little time. And, you know, fortunately, my father was a career diplomat. I grew up in Washington. So I'd been drinking the water all my life, so to speak. And, you know, the writing of that character was so extraordinary. And it was also... I think I pat myself on the back for being smart enough to recognize that it was actually a very different character in the culture of that show. You know, the kind of the dirty little secret about The West Wing, what made it so much fun to watch on a kind of voyeuristic, well, I mean, a level of fantasy, really, is here you had this great man in the White House who's surrounded by all these marvelous people who were bright and educated and had their hearts in the right place, who were completely worshipped him and loyal to him. And along came this guy who was actually just as loyal, but he was much more interested in tough love than necessarily – not that they kowtowed, but they were they treated him with kid gloves, you know. And here was a guy who recognized how much trouble this man was potentially in and was extremely direct with him. I think whoever played that part, you know, it would have landed because it was – the character really provided a counterpoint in a way. It cut across the current of the rest of the personalities in that show. And so all I really needed to do was to get on the horse and ride, you know. But and it's not an easy show to work on because you have to say all of the words exactly the way they're written, and which is not, you know, always my forte. And there's this nice little lady who sits behind the camera, not the script supervisor. And she would come out and tell you afterwards if you literally got an A or a the or a but wrong, and you'd have to do it all again. And, you know, that Oliver Babish, he was a talky fellow. And there were some big long speeches that I had to, and I didn't know, you know, because when I finally called Aaron said to me, you know, oh, Oliver, just, you know, we're so thrilled you're doing, just make it your own. And so when somebody says to me, make it your own, I thought he meant, oh, I can kind of like, you know, cross this out or make this more comfortable coming out of my mouth. That's not what Aaron meant. And, you know, Aaron has every right to not mean that. He just meant come and, you know, and have a good time and be you. So I had a little hazing that went on as I figured out that you had to say it exactly as it was written and sweat it out.
So you said that reading the script word for word isn't your forte. Is that because of bad memory or just wanting to make it more comfortable for you to say?
Television is much more of a writer's medium. And I hadn't done a lot of television at that time. And I'd done a lot of movies and you know, I came up doing movies in the 80s and the 90s when, you know, movies were very concept heavy and they were – the script wasn't always the most important thing. You know, big, huge multimillion dollar deals were made on napkins because a star had agreed to do some sort of idea and that this writer would do it. And, you know, the writers were often pulling their hair out being rewritten by, you know, I don't know, schlubs like me.
Could you give an example of the kind of line that Aaron Sorkin wrote that you'd maybe either get wrong or slightly rewrite to make it more comfortable for you and then you had to do it over again exactly as written?
The example I can give you is every single one, you know, because he's he's very fastidious and he has every right to be. And there's an absolute music and a rhythm to the way he writes. And it was a wonderful exercise for me as an actor, you know. Because God knows that's what we're supposed to do. You know, I'd gotten lazy or I'd gotten, you know, the conditions that I just described to you. It gives you a little bit of a sense of entitlement and it makes you lazy.
Since we were just talking about working on the TV series The West Wing, let's stay in the White House for a moment and hear a scene from Frost Nixon. And this is about the making of the now famous interviews that British journalist and talk show host David Frost recorded with President Nixon after Watergate. And you play Bob Zelnick, a journalist who was helping with the preparation of the interviews. And in this scene, as part of the prep, David Frost is doing a kind of rehearsal with you standing in for Nixon. So you're playing the part of Nixon in this little rehearsal that they're doing. And the scene begins with you doing a voiceover.
Because I had written about and watched Nixon for years, I got to play him in our rehearsals. You know, the fellows would throw me a question and I would try and anticipate what his response might be.
Okay, the White House taping system.
Ours was not the first administration to use taping systems. Lyndon Johnson's White House used them, so did Kennedy.
Houston plant, wiretapping, and alleged abuses of power.
Let me tell you, other administrations were up to far worse.
And just for fun, your close friend, Jack Kennedy.
That man, he screwed anything that moved, fixed elections, and took us into Vietnam. And the American people, they loved him for it. Whereas I, Richard Milhouse Nixon, worked around the clock in their service, and they hated me. Look. Look. Now I'm sweating.
Damn it. Damn it. I'm Kennedy so goddamn handsome. I'm blue-eyed. And women all over him. He anything that moved and everything. Had a go at Checkers once. The poor little bitch was never the same.
That's my guest, Oliver Platt, in a scene from Frost Nixon. Now, you were born in 1960. Did Watergate have any impact on you?
You know, it did, because we were living at the start of Watergate. I was living in Washington, actually. And then we were living in Japan when Nixon resigned. And I remember very clearly we were driving out to the country and the news came over the radio. My parents pulled the car over and they told us all to listen. I remember my parents being utterly consumed by the Watergate hearings, everybody being consumed by the Watergate hearings. And I just remember it being, you know, I was what? Nixon resigned in 72, 73. So is that right, Terry? So I was 12 or 13. And then, and you know, and it was what, several years.
74 maybe?
74. Like I say, I was conscious of my parents being obsessed by it. I didn't get interested in politics till I was a little bit older.
Now, your father was a career diplomat. He'd been he was an ambassador to Pakistan, Zambia, the Philippines. What were you doing in Japan?
That was an earlier point in his career. He wasn't an ambassador yet, but he was a senior member of the political section of the embassy. And I was, you know, I was going to school. I was just being an American teenager in Japan.
So what impact do you think Watergate had on your father, since he was at that point representing the Nixon administration?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, because, you know, my father actually went on all of those trips with first Secretary Rogers to China and then with Kissinger to China and then ultimately with Nixon to China.
Wow.
He's actually just published a memoir about it called China Boys, about the opening of China. And he really had a remarkable perspective on it. He has a home movie, you know, of Nixon getting off the plane and shaking Chou Enlai's hand. And he's standing literally, you know, 15 yards away from him when that happened. And so he really, I think my father had complicated feelings about it.
So when you had to play the part in For Us Nixon of Bob Zelnick, and you sat in for Nixon in this kind of role-play rehearsal of the David Frost interview, what were you going for when you were doing, like, an impression of Nixon?
Well, you know, it was very easy, because I unyoked myself from this expect. I talked to Ron about it, and we said, listen, the whole idea is that, you know, Bob Zelnick's not an actor. You don't have to be a good Nixon. You know, you could, as a matter of fact, the worse Nixon you are, the better, and, you know, maybe the funnier. And so I just kind of let loose with whatever I remembered about, you know, because everybody back in those days, you know, had a Nixon impression. You
absolutely.
You couldn't turn on, like, you'd watch Rowan and Martin's laughing and everybody was imitating Nixon, holding up their, you know, their arms and the peace signs and kind of hunching their shoulders and shaking their jowls, you know. So we just had fun with it. I didn't at all study any sort of Nixon. I just pulled it out of my memory, my perverse memory.
So where does acting come in? How did you get interested in acting?
You know, we moved regularly. We moved every 2 or 3 years, sometimes shorter spans than that. And, you know, it wasn't always easy being the new kid. You know, after one particularly difficult transition, I think when I came back from Hong Kong, and I came back and I went to quite a little bit of a Tony school in Washington, D.C. And I, you know, for whatever reason, I was the only new kid and I had a very, very difficult time. But for whatever reason, I auditioned for the Christmas pageant and I played. I was cast as the innkeeper who turned Mary, Joseph and the baby Jesus away from the inn. And I said my line and God knows why, but the place went nuts. it must be because I said it so inappropriately, because, you know, I don't think that, you know, the innkeeper turning Mary, Joseph and the baby Jesus away from the inn is necessarily a hilarious moment.
That's right.
but however I said it, I got a big reaction. And, you know, and it's a kind of, you know, when you are a I know this sounds so pathetic as I tell the story, but you pay attention. All of a sudden I was going, ooh, you know, I'll have a little more of this. You know, when you're like a friendless loser and all of a sudden, you know, you get a rise out of a group of people, no matter how inadvertent or wrongheaded, you remember it. And what happened? So I kept on auditioning for, I kept on, you know, doing school plays. And it became this instant way, you know, because I kept on moving around, of course. And then it became kind of instant way to plug in to a group, you know, to a subculture, to a group of friends. It really was a survival mechanism, you know.
Had you been in musicals before?
I had been in musicals in high school. But, you know, the high school musical and the Broadway musical are two completely different beasts. I'd done plays before, you know, in the professional environment. And you're really worrying about the play and the text. But with a musical, there's choreography, there's learning the songs, there's, you know, quote-unquote dancing, which I only say quote-unquote because, they were very, very kind about the demands they put on me for dancing. There's just a lot of difference. There's a lot of stuff. And it makes it thrilling, you know, once you figure out how to do it. You know, I'll never forget, like, the first time we're sitting in these beautiful rehearsal studios on 42nd Street that have these huge windows, and you're kind of looking out over Times Square and Broadway. And the first time, you know, that I was sitting in the middle of this chorus of singers in the cast, and the first time we all sang, you know, Luck Be a Lady. I mean, you're just sitting there going, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this, you know.
So, sadly, this Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls that you were in did not get great reviews, and it closed in a few months. Was that kind of heartbreaking for you?
You know, it wasn't easy, but we got to do it for a while. And, you know, when the show wasn't well received, we were all disappointed. And your first, you know, your first response is, oh, God, I wish this would just go away. But then when it didn't, you settled into it. And, you know, it's Guys and Dolls, and people would come, and despite what the critics said, they would have a ball. And, you know, I don't know how to describe it. You know, there's something about working in that environment that is absolutely magic. You know, I'd run off stage right. I have to make an exit stage left in 47 seconds. You run down the stairs, you know, three sweaty dancing girls, you know, in their hot box outfits pass you, you know, giggling on the way up the stairs. You take a right. You pass the wig room. You look in the wig room. There's a guy dressed in a pinstripe suit, like trying to put the moves on one of the hairdressers. You know, you're trying to follow this little yellow line. You hear the washing machines humming, you know, because they're already doing the clothes. Then you pass like the trap room. There's a guy sitting in front of a glowing monitor pressing buttons because something isn't functioning. You finally get to the stairs. You're ready to go up. And then like Benny South Street and Nicely come barreling down the stairs, you know, like laughing about something that just went wrong on stage. And then you barrel up the stairs, and then you see the security guard, and he's watching the Yankee game. You know, he's lit by the glow of the Yankee game. He's got this earpiece in, but he's drooling, and he's asleep, and he's perfectly lit by this little spotlight above. And then you rush back on stage, and then the whole time you're listening to this gorgeous Frank Lesser music. And once again you go, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this.
You know, I especially noticed in your new movie, Please Give, how tall you are. You kind of tower over the actress who plays your daughter, and you tower over Catherine Keener. You're a big man.
Well, thank you.
How do you feel like you use your size in different performances?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Sometimes it needs to be used, and sometimes it wants to be not used, you know. And the great thing about film is that they can make you as short or tall as they want, you know, by putting other actors on boxes or putting you in a ditch. You know, I have to say the honest answer is I don't think about it too much, you know. I think about it if I need it. And then I realize that it's just there. You know, if I have to be imposing, I just, you know, it's talk softly and carry a big stick. I mean, I kind of... You are the big stick. You know what I mean? If you have that size.
So what's a role where you've used it to be imposing? West Wing?
You know, maybe Oliver Babish, since we've been talking about that a little bit. Uh-huh. You know, he was a very imposing character.
Now, how do you think your size affects the roles that you're cast in?
A lot of directors are surprised by my size. They think that I'm shorter. I think it affects it maybe secondarily, but it's not like people say, let's get that guy, he's so tall. People are almost always surprised by it.
What about being like a little husky?
I think that, you know, I don't know. I wonder about that endlessly. I think that sometimes it keeps me away from certain roles. I think it gets me other roles. And in the end, it's probably a wash, but it's just what I am.
Well, Oliver Platt, I wish you good luck with your new movie and your new TV series, and I really want to thank you for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Oliver Platt stars with Catherine Keener in the new film Please Give. It has its New York premiere tonight at the Tribeca Film Festival and opens Friday in New York and L.A. You can see clips from Please Give on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.